requirement of the Louisiana Constitution, but that was my main job. So I had, there was another guy working with me, another guy working with me on agriculture, and we were given an interpreter and a driver, and we had the freedom to do lots of different sorts of things. They set up meetings for us at the large collecting farms. One day we just said, can we just drive anywhere we want to and talk to people in the countryside? We did that, so we did all of those sorts of things. And then, of course, I had to work with, I needed to work with the government officials. They really left most of the bureaucracy in place because they had this election, but they didn't know exactly where it goes. So I was working a lot with the Minister of Agriculture, and he was the Minister of Agriculture under the previous Soviet-like regime. And for him, so we were going through all these sorts of things, and I was walking to lunch with him one day, and he said, you know, I just really have problems with what you're telling me. We raise a lot of chickens in Bulgaria. By the way, Bulgaria had a lot of potential for agriculture. They're kind of what have been called the garden spot of Europe. So good climate, good soil. So as they were, as we were walking, he said, presently, with our big chicken farms and our grain growers, we know how to get that grain there. We put in a plan, there'll be a certain amount of grain grown, will be processed at this particular place, will be hauled by these particular trucks, and it will go to these chicken farms. In your system, there isn't going to be any plan. How can you assure me that there will be chicken food for the chicken farmers? And I gave what I thought was kind of an answer, but turned out to be kind of flip. I said, don't worry. It'll just happen. He said, well, yeah, but you know, there's chicken farmers, the grain farmers have to know what to grow, and they have to know where to process it. How are they going to get the right process? You know, I'm not a grain processed. And I said, don't worry. It'll just happen. He said, well, what about the transportation? You're going to have to be all sorts of lorries, trucks that are going to be hauling this. We're going to have drivers. We're going to have to get it to the right place. And how's this going to work? Yes, I kind of felt like I was just doing this little happy foot dance and saying, be happy, don't worry, be happy, don't worry, because that's what I was telling him. It was very hard for him to get his mind around the fact that the goods and services would go to the right place at the right time by virtue of a property rights price system. Information just gets communicated all over the place in interesting sorts of ways. When you were packing to come here, did your spouse say to you, well, dear, did you put your coffee in? I don't know if there'll be any coffee in Tempe. You know, maybe they don't have coffee there. So what do you mean they don't have coffee? Well, you know, have you ever been there? Do you know how they drink coffee there? Probably, unless you're just, you know, a real coffee aficionado, you probably didn't pack your coffee. Because you're reasonably assured that you can get a ride from the airport, that there will be heat in your room, that there will be coffee that will be available. And now I know we have a contract with this particular resort, but it's all of that's been carried out by this kind of invisible price coordination system. But it does mean that all of this is an impersonal exchange. So I want to talk about the teleology of the entrepreneurial economy when there is impersonal exchange. Now, there are expanded opportunities to serve and be served. Part of our stewardship responsibilities are to serve other people. Then clearly, in this economy, we have all of this specialization that increases our capacity, and all of these price signals that convey information that is otherwise not conveyable. There's no good way to convey it other than through prices. And if you try other means, you're going to lose a lot of it. This means we've got tremendous opportunities to serve people. Our realm of serving has actually expanded. And you're going to be served by other people in all sorts of ways because for specialization, price coordination, all those sorts of things. So that's a nice sort of a thing that can come out of it. It does enable us to develop the economic capacity that can complement our compassion. Certainly can't replace it, but can complement it, what Tom was talking about. The interesting question, though, is what does it do to our character? And for many Christian thinkers, participation in the market economy is really problematic. They would say, well, we can't think of a better way to do it right off the bat than people like Stephen Long, Catherine Tanner, Daniel Bell, William Kavanaugh. They've all written essays, books, where they say, you know, it just the economy just does bad things to you. It forms your character. In particular, they think about the the marketplace being a place where there's just extrinsic rewards, and so that drives out the intrinsic value that we need from activities that give meaning to our life. Okay, there's something called experimental economics, and we're going to do a little experimental economics here in order to try to tease out some of this. This won't be definitive, but maybe it'll give us some insights here. We start the ultimatum game with my little game playing resources here, with a fixed sum of money that's available to two participants. I'm going to start with $10. There's going to be four teams of two people. You're going to have to decide how to divide that money. I'm going to pick one of you in each team. That's going to be what I'm going to call the proposer. You get to decide how you want to divide it. There's going to be another person on the team, and I'm going to try to make these as anonymous as possible so you're not sitting across the table from each other. And then I really try to make it completely anonymous, playing with people you don't know at all. Oftentimes they're sitting in computer terminals or academic students, people they ask to participate. So the proposer makes an offer to the respondent. And it says, this is how the proposer is the first mover. The proposer controls the money to start with. And the respondent then, and then so the proposer makes this offer. Says how the money will be split. And so let's say he says six and four. I'm going to keep $6, you're going to get four. The respondent has the option now of accepting the offer. If the respondent accepts the offer, and I put dollar bills in here and I'm going to say you can't do anything other than dollar units because I didn't bring enough change to do that. But we're going to go with that. But the interesting thing is, might say eight and two. I'm going to keep eight and give you two. The respondent can say, no way. I don't like that. That's unfair. Then what happens is neither of you get the money. I keep the money. So this is an interesting dynamic in which you can think about how do you want to play the game, because it's going to be a mutual, or you can do some back induction and think about what's going to happen in these sorts of cases. So, we're going to start the game here. I'm going to need four volunteers that I'm going to take out of the room. Boy, thank you. We got four hands right here immediately. Aren't you four? Come right on outside. Boy, was that quick. By the way, there is no magic. We're not searching for some magic solution. There's not an answer here, a correct answer that we're trying to go with. Okay. Yeah, you're one of them. Sorry, let's see. Have we got three? You're in. Okay.
Found out earlier too. These are nice thick doors.
You're going to draw one of these cards.
TJ, your mic's on.
And you're
Oh, that's right.
Show will be back on in a moment, folks.
While we're waiting, I had a little problem with the audio recording in the first part of the talk. If any of you is like making a voice memo of this, could you send that to me? All right, good. We make a podcast version of all these presentations available through the website after each retreat. With the PowerPoints will be available and everything. Look for that in the February edition of the newsletter. So assuming Chris's audio is working, we'll get that edited together. All right.
Greg,
is the
Paul Williams video that you played yesterday, is that available somewhere?
Not yet, but it should be. I will refrain from pointing to the person whose job it is to get it out. There's a person in this room whose job it is to get it out, but I will not speak the name or point. But the videos from the retreat are starting now to come out, but they're coming out in batches. So the first batch is out. You can go to YouTube and see them. Paul's is not in the first batch, but they're going to be coming. So that will be publicly available.
And I can find it.
Yes, you'll be able to find it. Yeah, if you go on YouTube and search for Faith and then the at symbol and then Work Summit, you'll find their channel, and all those videos are on the channel. All right.
Okay, now we're back.
When it's available, yeah.
It's all you.
all my resources. Thank you for warning me about the Okay, so now we need four volunteers who are going to be the people that respond. Well, thank you, board, for responding. I appreciate that very much. Draw. Jeff, you want to take a number here? Okay, take any one of these three numbers. Okay, now I'm going to ask, you're going to get your offer here. I don't want you to, I don't want you to call out what you're doing at this point. Number two. Okay, here's your offer, right on there, accept or reject. Number four, okay. Number one, okay, that write down, accept or reject. Somebody tell, no, I want to wait until we get these offers in, so if I can collect your card now, you have to remember who you are. Okay, somebody ask them to come back in. Okay, here are the offers. Number one made an offer of $5. Number three made an offer of $5. Number four made an offer, not quite so generous, $4. Number two made an offer of $4. Here's the fun part. They all accept it. Now I'll talk a little bit more about the results. So which one were you? Were you number one? Number one, so you get $5. Huh? Okay, what number were you? Back in there. You were number four. Thank you. There's my envelope here. Number four, you get $4. And what number were you? Two. So you get a different envelope here.
Well, I mean, I guess all four of them will know who they are.
You get $4. And
it's anonymous. That permits you to make a lower offer with minimal reputational cost.
You get them, and you get,
like PJ said before, they do this in isolated booths with computer terminals when they really do it. So
three,
you get really isolated.
Four, five.
Okay.
Number four, you get $4. Okay, now to pay off the people who the respondents or the proposers have here, and you can see up there what you made, so I'm going to trust you. I don't have the envelope's number right, but you know some of you are getting five and some of you are getting six. So so honestly take your number up. I do have students, I don't give them that sort of option. Okay, well, this is an interesting sort of a game, and we can look at results around the world as we play it. This has been played with university, but played a lot of different people. But one of the places it's been played is with university students from a wide variety of backgrounds. From these places, their average offer was 40%, and some of the time, or the average rejected offer was 20%. If your offer was only offered 20%, then there's a pretty good chance you're going to reject it. Now, and you folks were pretty generous. That has anything to do with your particular background here, what's going on. But some people, as you think about it, one of the first things, what does this tell us? It tells us good old homo economicus does not apply. Because if it's strictly wealth maximization, the proposer says, this person doesn't have anything to start with. If I make them a dollar offer, that's better than nothing. So I will surely, and so offers will tend to be around a dollar. And what's the respondent say? Well, I would like more, but I got my dollar, that's fine. That does not explain this sort of behavior. What's going on? People are willing to undergo costs because of a sense of fairness. It doesn't cost them. I mean, this is a world that started with nothing, and all of a sudden there's $10 out there, and we're talking about how we're going to do it. And so it's interesting that people do, they will say, I will forego money because you didn't play fair. Now, economics isn't very good at predicting that sort of behavior. One of the faults of economics is that it thinks about people just as rational, wealth-maximizing creatures. A lot of economics has moved beyond that, but that's still kind of the basic of what we teach our students in our introductory courses, how we think about people, how we try to explain behavior. Interestingly enough, this game has been played lots of times. There's always some people that are willing to reject, and in fact, there's other sorts of games you can play where you look at the division. Now, in this case, the respondent can say, you didn't play fair with me, I'm going to punish you. You can actually play the game in which it hasn't hurt the person making the respondent, hasn't hurt them. And it's just been not what you think is a fair offer. So people are actually willing to undergo costs to impose standards of fairness, even if they haven't been hurt personally by that. It says something about maybe our innate being that's created in the image of God. Now here's where it really gets interesting, as far as I'm concerned. They played this game with 15 very small-scale, non-modern societies. Three were foraging, 6 were practice slash and burn, 4 were nomadic herding groups, 2 sedentary, 2 small-scale agricultural societies. In these non-modern societies, the offers vary much more across the board than with the... Forward here about the Omega game, and you look about how it's been played. With this one, with the university students, interestingly enough, there were some differences, but there were no cultural differences. You could not predict that the offers were going to be higher. And we talk about individualistic societies or collective societies or communal societies, and in that group, there's some very different cultural backgrounds. Didn't make any difference in terms of explaining. The differences were not systematic across because of particular cultural backgrounds among these groups. So there's no difference in the results across these groups. With these small, non-modern societies, we got much more variation than we did among the university students. When I say we, I'm reading other people's work on this. I run the experiment myself, but not in these sorts of settings. The offers varied a lot more. Rejection rates also, but we had offers, they're from 26% to 58%, much greater variation. Rejection rates were also quite varied. Sometimes people would wouldn't reject offers of 1 out of 10 or 10%. They wouldn't reject offers of 20. So they didn't seem to be, they didn't seem to be quite so interested in making kind of what we would call equal offers, and they were quite willing to accept these offers that were very unequal. So, economists, Greg points out, are social scientists, we like to think about these sorts of things. So they ask, how do we explain this? Do we explain it by the sex makeup of the people? Can we explain it by age? Can we explain it by relative wealth? By the way, in order to make this kind of common across societies, the game was always played with between 1 and 2 days of wages. So the amount that's played in Pittsburgh is different than what's played in agricultural societies, different than was played in Slovenia. So they tried to make it so it's kind of what people would think of as a certain amount of money in their society. Well, relative wealth didn't make a difference. Village population size didn't make a difference. And then some people thought about, in some of these cases, the person that's doing this experiment has actually lived in the society for a long period of time, say for 6 months or a year. They're oftentimes anthropologists living there and recording all sorts of things. In others of them, it was the case that they were the experimenters kind of came to the village in order to try to play the game. That didn't make a difference. What did make a difference? Things that were what economists would call statistically significant. First of all, the amount of cooperative activity in production. Some of these societies, people just produced by themselves. They were out there, you know, doing subsistence farming, fishing, doing those sorts of things. In others, given the way the society was structured, you work with other people in a productive setting more. The more you did that, the more likely your initial offer was going to be higher and that your rejection rate was going to be higher. In other words, it seemed to develop people's consciousness about we're all in this together, we need to cooperate. The other thing that made an interesting difference was market integration. I've asked my students this, asked them to write a paper on this, just a very short paper. Do you think exposure to markets from non-traditional societies, non-modern, makes you more or less self-interested? The standard answer is, of course, you get into markets and they're really debasing you. The opposite effect. Some of these societies have almost no contact with the outside world. Others would produce goods and they take them out and trade them. What's going on here? Well, and again, the more that you traded in markets, the more likely you were to play it as a cooperative game, higher initial offer, more willingness to punish people who don't cooperate. Fascinating in terms of what exposure to a market does. Now, this isn't all, you know, doesn't explain all behavior, it's not the only sort of thing, but it does give us some interesting insights here. And I want to talk about what I'll call the telos of markets. Is there a telos? Is a person's authenticity and dignity compromised when you enter into exchange relations? And I think this is important because those of you that are thinking about introducing people into the market economy, interesting question, are they just being introduced so they get more wealth? Or are some things happening to them character-wise? Because you would have a certain degree of askance if you introduce them and say, oh, I know it's okay, but you're probably going to come out of a worse person than what you were before. And so the question is, does mutual collaboration for the common good that Thomas talked about, does it deform or form our character, our virtues? And I want to argue that there is a telos of market production and exchange. They do have a purpose beyond the production of goods and services. And the purpose is learning about and integrating into your lives mutual benefit. Learning something about entering into a relationship where you're benefiting, but the other person's benefiting. By the way, there's an interesting article by some economist philosophers that make this very argument, that there is a telos of markets or of exchange. And so the interesting thing is, by evidently practicing these sorts of work and exchange relationships, we can learn more about being a part of a cooperative world. Now, this is not a theory of altruism. Altruism is very important. It's not a theory of non-selfish behavior in one sense. In another sense, it is. But it's a theory of, even if you're acting in your own benefit, can you see that as a part of a larger whole? And can you understand that as a part of this process of mutual benefit? It is a distinctive moral attitude towards markets. It's an attitude that's characterized by reciprocity. It's a reciprocity among people who don't know each other. And that's the interesting thing. It's a reciprocity among strangers. People that you don't plan to meet. Now, you still have a lot of personal relationships in the market. You know the people that are engaged in production with you. You often have to want to buy your commodities from people that you know. You may want to go to an automobile mechanic that you've been to before. So it doesn't say there's no personal relationships, but that auto mechanic is going to get the parts from some place that you don't even know about. In fact, an interesting tidbit from economic history, Eli Whitney is well known for the cotton gin. Eli Whitney's probably more important contribution was the development of standardized parts. So you could actually produce goods and have parts be the same. When I want to order a pulley wheel for my animal case complex, I'll use that as an example, but say for my case tractor, I want a part for it. And I have that part number. And I go to town and I order that part. And they pull it off the shelf. I am very, very confident if I've got the part number right, it is going to fit. That's really quite amazing, because until Eli Whitney came along in the 1790s, basically all parts had been built. What he did is he got a contract with an armory to produce guns, and he produced a whole bunch of them, and he took them to the federal government, and he said, take them all apart. Took 100 guns, took them all apart. Put the parts in a pile in the middle of the floor. He said, okay, now assemble some guns. Reassemble. He did. And they fit. They were absolutely amazing. You couldn't do that with guns. So just that sort of an idea. So all of that happens in this sort of situation. And I would say that participants actually, not always stating it up front, but participants actually intend to benefit other people. They go into that thinking about, well, this is a mutually beneficial sort of a process. Okay? Now, in this, trust is an important part of the process, and in order for this to work, participants must reward trust and trustworthiness, and they must punish people who violate that trust. Something we need to. Okay, so I kind of lost my power over here, fortunately. Now I've even got a new PowerPoint. Let's see if I can make this work. Aha, power is my. Okay, if there is mutual benefit, then being an entrepreneur is a virtue, because you are seeking out mutual benefit for other people. That's important. Think about it that way. Have you thought about the fact that whenever you make an exchange with another person, you buy something in the marketplace, you are making a moral statement. You're making a statement about the moral agency of the people on the other side of that exchange, about their moral equality, about their dignity. Now, we worry about that. Things are produced by slave labor, those sorts of issues. But implicit in these sorts of exchanges is this moral equality or moral dignity sort of argument. That's a part of the exchange process. You're expressing that. You're expressing trust in their ability to be agents, moral agents deciding for themselves. They're part of a larger world, but that's what's going on. So every time we do that, you're practicing mutual benefit. You're practicing understanding the other person on the other side of the exchange, even though they are strangers. So, this is my answer to the larger question that I raised. I think that introducing the marginalizing press to the world of work and exchange is actually enabling them. It's empowering them to develop respect for them and respect for others. And understanding that they work themselves and they can earn respect by doing that, but it's not just for them. They're developing this whole idea of mutual benefit. So, of course, loving strangers through work and exchange is not the only domain of importance. Lots of other domains, the family, the church, the community, friendships, there's just lots of other things. So again, economists sometimes sound as if we think this is the only domain that matters. It's not. The other interesting thing is seeing work and exchange as an important intermediary for development of virtue doesn't rule out redistribution. It may mean redistribution enabled, what I mean is transferring resources away from some people to other people, and particularly voluntarily in the church or in other sorts of communities, to enable them to have the beginnings of resources or assets to be able to do this. And it may also mean coercive redistribution. So all of this argument doesn't say, boy, markets are the place to develop virtue, and you don't need to do anything else to do anything about that. So that's it. Loving strangers through work and exchange. So we've got half an hour left, and we'll go anywhere you want to go. Issues I talked about or didn't talk about.
PJ, yesterday we were talking about the use of the word economy, mm-hmm. and how that even in this discussion of the last years, the way that we've been using it as theologians has kind of changed, mm-hmm. and we're wrestling with a good definition of, if I was to explain to a pastor what is the economy, and I realize that's a huge study in itself, but if you, and they said to me, wait, you're going to answer that question, so there you are, here I am, give us a useful definition,
okay.
a nice usable definition So the ideologian can understand.
Yeah, I can do better with what economics is than I can with economy. Economy is just these set of production to consumption, set of relationships. But the important thing for me is that economics is the study of the social coordination mechanism by which we produce, through which we produce an exchange. So I think of it as the study of the social coordination mechanism. So the economy, in some sense, is the social coordination mechanism geared more around production and exchange than other sorts of things. I mean, you know, you can say the church is a part of the economy, but the economy is basically these relationships of production and exchange. And economies differ across time and space by what they've chosen to use as their core social coordination mechanism. What I'm calling the entrepreneurial economy relies heavily upon property rights and prices, not exclusively, as the coordination mechanism. It allows people the freedom of the entrepreneurs, freedom of the labor market, all of those sorts of things. So that would be my effort. Anybody want to try to add to that? Greg, you want to try to add to what we mean by economy?
I think the only thing I would add to that is I made a fascinating discovery that until the early 20th century, the word economy was not used the way we use it now. At least I found some authors asserting this, and I haven't found any counterexamples, that the word economy used to mean the virtue of thriftiness, right? You would say, well, that person really practices economy, or that household really has good economy. It means they don't waste, you know, and they manage their resources well. The whole idea of the economy emerges in the early 20th century in the context of the study of macroeconomics, right? The field of macroeconomics is emerging, and they had to talk about what they were studying. And so the idea that it's a sort of sociological abstraction, and that's why we don't have a good definition of it, because it's this big sociological reality. In some ways, it's a useful word because it's ambiguous, right? When you say economics, people have very, very narrow idea of what that means. It means either numbers on spreadsheets, or it means talking heads on TV yelling at each other about public policy. And so I find the economy is more useful in some ways because nobody knows what it means. It means you can start to have a conversation without all the baggage.
Yes, Charlie.
PJ, with your love of history as well, one of the things that I think is interesting, there's a lot of histrionics over public, private, government, enterprise that we all confront. Mm-hmm. Because we just love our parishioners and serve our cities. It's interesting that in every economy I've studied, there is a moral sensibility. And I'd like to maybe address some examples, because one of my mentors in the university studied bread riots. And it was interesting, in a stratified society, people were nonviolent as long as bread didn't exceed 50% of their daily income. And then the bread riots occurred when the bread price went up over 50% of daily income in parts of England. But I'd just be curious, because you've been involved in public policy as well as private enterprise. Could you share a little bit, both from history and observation, how to help us find language to navigate both the moral sensibility and then the public-private pressures that we face?
Mm. Well, I don't know where I'm going with that, Charlie. I'll start talking and see what happens, which I oftentimes do. First of all, my take on the phenomenon of bread riots is that it is a somewhat modern phenomenon in the sense that historically people would live in abject poverty and they wouldn't expect the price of bread to be part of the consumption. So I think, if I'm correct, that this happens in societies that at least have some level of development. And then there's a change of expectations. And one of the big things that we think about my symbol is the first graph. If you were living in 1300, or you were living in 1500, or you were living in 1700, anywhere in the world, if you were an ordinary citizen, you just did not expect to do better. You expected yourself to be subject to the vicissitudes of drought, of famine, and the marauding bands. You know, the level of violence was pretty high. So I don't think of, I don't think there's, no, I could be wrong, when he was talking about the bread riots, was that
14th century.
Okay, that's interesting, it's back
there. You're correct, though, it's a developed economy, a village economy, so there's still that exchange you're speaking of.
Okay, okay, so, so yeah, I don't know, there is the problem of increased expectations, and if we continually believe we're always going to be doing better, it's interesting that sometimes you can say discontent is the gap between your expectations and reality. And one of the problems that I think we have built into our society is this expectation that you can always, that you'll be doing better economically. And that, I mean, we're living in a fortunate sort of time that hasn't, basically that's been happening, but after 2008 that didn't happen for a lot of people. So I think there are some cautions in terms of trying to give people a sense of the unusualness of economic growth and a willingness to live with a world where there may be periods without as much growth. Now that's, we can talk about those sorts of things, you know, what causes that. Let me come to a more modern sort of case though. In many countries of the world, there are food riots and there's fuel riots. And that oftentimes is because the government has chosen to provide those goods at a below market price, and it becomes a huge portion of the budget. The Egyptian budget is just being killed by their fuel subsidies. You know, the fact that they feel like they've got to provide fuel. Now it turns out that doesn't go to the poorest of the poor, that goes to the people that have vehicles. Now some of them are using the fuel for heat or for cooking. Indonesia's facing the same sort of problem. Once you build those sorts of subsidy programs in, they are just very, very difficult to get out. So you get some riots out of that. Let me go back to your original question. So to the private-public partnership sort of thing. Well, it seems to me that the fundamental function of government is to provide order. You know, it is to try to provide for an orderly society. Beyond that, I think most of the issues are what I would call prudential. At some point in time, a society may be wealthy enough that it will decide that it can actually do, you know, provide things, or may have a moral framework such that it wants to try to benefit people. Again, it's always interesting to me when we talk about, you know, efforts to try to reduce poverty, and those are very laudable. Almost all of the political rhetoric about reducing poverty ignores economic growth. And throughout history, economic growth has just been the vehicle that has dramatically reduced poverty. So you can't ignore that as a way of taking care of the poor and the least of these. Now, there are some people that are absolutely left out of the growing economy. It's usually because of some dysfunctionality, maybe, you know, mental capacity, maybe they're injured, some things like that. Sometimes it's actually the background, family dysfunctionality. But so when we get to this public-private partnership, I clearly see the public partnership as providing the legal framework, underlined by a moral framework that says that you ought to respect the dignity of other people. So that's not a particular clear answer, but that's about as far as I can go.
PJ, one of the things that I've really appreciated about your research and your thinking that has benefited me a great deal, not only thoughtfully, but also working with millennials or just, you know, the people on the street, not mm-hmm. condescendingly, but and I hear this from corporate leaders and that kind of thing. Here's the thought, maybe you could articulate more of this. You touched on this in our meeting and research. I think the perception, at least I hear, if you just put on my pastoral hat on the ground, is this tension of, you know, private sphere, entrepreneurial market, public sphere, and the worker within that context, motivated by, I'll use the word self-interest versus selfishness. Would you comment? Because I think the research really confronts the perception on the street that I hear, that one domain of the worker in that context is deeply self-interested and the other is more elegant. Would you? I thought the research was fascinating to me.
So basically, what's
the private sphere?
Tom was talking about it, so I did a short presentation. I think all the short my presentations are short. to the committee on Thursday, and I talked about the perception of markets and what we call market failure. So there's a, now this is just a technical term with regard to why markets don't work well, monopoly problems, say externality problems, but the idea is if we can identify a problem in the private sector, we know what to do. We remand it to the public sector and it will be solved. Well, as economics has kind of gone on over time, they've applied the same way of thinking about people in the public sector as in the private sector. They seem to have about the same motivations. They're altruistic part of the time, they care about other people, they're committed to the public good, not completely committed to the public good. But the idea oftentimes is that people in the private sector are motivated by either self-interest or greed, but things that are done by government are motivated by, they're always working in the public interest. Well, I would say that people in the private sector are working in the public interest. Ken Elsing, probably the best known Christian economist among the circles that I move in, I'm an economist at the University of Virginia, gave a talk last spring at Wheaton College, and I was there for it. And he was talking about one of his students who came in, and she said, I really want to work for the, I want to do something in the public interest. What can I do? So he asked her about her background, and she was from, her family had a plumbing firm in Virginia. And he said, well, what about going to work for your family plumbing firm? She said, no, I want to do something in the public interest. He said, well, maybe producing and selling sinks and toilets is in the public interest. Working there would be in the public interest. But there is that bifurcation. And I would say we want the public to do certain things that we would like it, that we don't think the market is going to do well for us, and sometimes provision for marginalized and other sorts of things we may want the government to step in. There's lots of prudential sorts of considerations there in terms of preserving the dignity of the recipient and the dignity of the giver. But again, I just see it as there's some things that the coercive power of government is very useful to do. And I want to think about those, I want to remand to government the things that the, and that's what distinguishes government from other agencies. It is the one agency in the society that has a legitimate monopoly on coercion. The other people that have monopolies aren't going to use coercion inappropriately. But throughout the year, most of you have been seeing money being taken out of your bank account or your paycheck. You might not particularly like it, but you don't raise this huge ruckus. On the other hand, if I went to Ben and got hold of his PIN number and got to his bank account and was able to take 20% of his income, just flat take it, I think Ben's reaction would be different when he sees those reductions for FICA and for the income tax. All we grant a monopoly to take our money, to do the sorts of things we want. And so that's the distinction. That, to me, is much different than distinguishing between the motivation of the people. And I still think that people in the private and the public sector have a moral framework that they think about, and we need that moral framework when we run our screen, we run things through. And we also need to think about the incentives that the decision maker faces and the information that they have. Those are going to influence them a lot. The U.S. Forest Service, for years, Forest Service district supervisors were rewarded for the amount of roads they built and the amount of timber that they harvested. Now, I think we've actually overreacted, and from my perspective, we've cut out too much timber harvest. But what happens if you reward the district managers? Their budget goes up if they build more roads and they harvest more timber. So they would actually, they would take timber bids that a private company would never have taken. They were trying to, say, so oftentimes, harvest timber on the north side of a mountain in, say, Washington or Idaho or Montana. And that timber didn't on the north side, didn't grow very fast, and so it's hardly worth harvesting. The Forest Service in that region would package the bid so you had to bid on the north side of the mountain, the timber there. Why? Their incentives were tied to selling more timber. And so that doesn't mean that they're evil, it just means that they faced a particular incentive. Let me move back here, yes.
PJ, time. Some of what Bob was doing yesterday to question now. Has there been a comparable intuition among economists that we've moved from a hierarchical era in the industrial period to a kind of flattening out of bureaucracies and economies in the information age? And then a follow-up, we've been interested in how institutions like seminaries change in the information age. Any ideas about encouraging stakeholders, i.e. faculty members, to feel like they've got a part of responsibility for some sort of mutual benefit? And often the temptation is, the tendency is, for faculties to think of themselves simply as receiving a paycheck and doing something. So there's mutual benefit language doesn't always seem to work.
Yeah. A couple of responses. First, when you talk about kind of ordinary organizational behavior, what we call firm-level organization, that oftentimes is a little bit more in business schools than it is among economists. It's not something that I have worked on much, but there is a general recognition in business schools that we have lots of different models and that that flat sorts of organizational structures may be better than higher. The interesting thing is, in the private sector, there's this continual search for the right organizational form because you have a bottom line. So you just always reorganizing firms and thinking of there's all these management books about the best way to do it. And so there's a very real sort of a dynamic there in which there's pretty immediate feedback. In fact, think of that. I mean, a lot of people decry takeover artists, people who take over firms and, you know, put a bunch of money together and take over control. What are they doing? They're saying we can use these resources better than you folks that presently own it are using them, and we may impose an entirely different organizational form, but that's part of the dynamic of the economy. Now, when you get to seminaries, it becomes more difficult to not-for-profit institutions because there just isn't as much feedback. I think they need to be what we would call not-for-profit, but the organization, it becomes more difficult to get what we would call complete buy-in, and there's not nearly as much dynamic because you don't get feedback. Now, Bob Cooley gave us some interesting data in terms of, you know, some feedback's going to have to happen, and you are going to get it because there still is a bottom line. I must confess that I don't have I'm not into organizational psychology enough to tell you how you get people to get buy-in. My experience was that I taught at secular universities for 15 or 16 years, mostly part-time, so I could go back and be a cowboy, maybe a failed cowboy is the right term. I got thrown twice the last summer. I sold my ranch in 2012. Part of the problem was I kept getting bucked off. And part of the problem was I'm much stiffer now than I used to be. And when I swing up, my horses generally are ready to do something, and I've got to get that right stirrup. I can ride pretty well if I get that right stirrup. If they start bucking before I get that right stirrup, I'm oftentimes going off, and so that's my failed cowboy part of it. But for me, from going from secular universities to Wheaton College was just an enormous difference because there was buy-in. We were part of a common project, and it was just so refreshing. Some of the faculty we would complain about, we don't have this, we don't have that, and I said, boy, you should spend some time at a state university in which everybody, there was almost no institutional loyalty. Now that's just a comment, a fact. I do think that articulating the mutual benefit, the common goals, we're in this together, this is a useful sort of an exercise. Yes?
The phrase income inequality is used much, much more, it seems to me, today than it was a decade ago. In fact, I don't recall hearing it. And it's presented as a moral problem, and we're supposed to recognize it, I think, intuitively as a moral issue. Would you offer us a little help in sort of thinking about this as an issue?
Yeah, that's a lecture that I hope to prepare for either just the committee or maybe the larger group at some point, but I hope you can hear the question. The question is income inequality. It is a moral issue. There's a whole question about again, is what's being generated in the economy being captured through kind of rules of fairness? Is it fair that the income of the top 1% has gone up dramatically compared to the income of the middle? By the way, the data on the on what we call middle class or median income stagnation, I just don't think is true. If you look, if you get behind the data, the people in the middle have had their incomes increase fairly substantially over the last 25 or 30 years. From 2008 to 2011 or 12, you know, things pretty much stagnated. But there have been real increases during that period. But it has not been nearly as much as the increases at the top. For me, the way you think about inequality is to ask, how do people get their income? And if they get it by playing positive sum games, and kind of the assumption is that the top 1%, we look at their income, and the kind of behind that is, if only they didn't have it, we would have it. That's not necessarily true. If it's a voluntary sort of transfer, transactions, many times they're entrepreneurs that have been able to benefit the society. So I want to go behind the income inequality and ask, how did they get their wealth? I don't think that Bill Gates impoverished me. I think he actually improved my world. Now, Bill Gates got a lot of money out of that. But I don't think I should begrudge him that money, because and the data says that an entrepreneur like Bill Gates will capture between 2 and 3% of the gain that they produce for society.
It seems, though, we should be less concerned, in a sense, with what Bill Gates is doing, and more concerned with, is there, in other words, there could be an increase in inequality and still progress.
Sure.
At the same time, which could be a healthy progress.
Right.
But the gap could be greater.
The gap could be greater, and that's why I don't think measuring the gap does that much good, because if the people that are getting the, and it may well be, and part of it may be more of a globalized economy, that somebody that's a very successful entrepreneur now sells their product worldwide. I used the example, maybe for some of you in this group have seen it before, J.K. Rowling and her Harry Potter series. If she would have written a very popular book in 1890, she would have sold in England and maybe across the channel. She sold it all over the world. So now when we find somebody that's what you might call a superstar, because of the globalization of the economy, their wealth increases a lot. So yeah, you're right. But I just think the gap is not a very good measure. I'll tell you my biggest concern, the other thing is lots of mobility in and out of that gap. Gotta get back over here where I can see my clock and see how I'm doing. My biggest concern is not the people at the top. If you look at income mobility and you divide the what we call income quintiles, the 20% groups, everybody moves over 10 years a lot, except for the bottom half of the bottom 20%. And those are the people that I think we really need to be concerned about. They're locked in, sometimes because they've got bad behaviors themselves, sometimes because they don't have good educational opportunities, sometimes because of family breakup. Just there's lots of reasons. But when people talk about, oh, we got to be thinking about the inequality thing, I want to think about how people are doing. Carol.
I'm going to confess this is a pushback question.
Okay, good. I need to pushback.
Okay.
You hope it's too easy.
So let me ask it this way. So what are the prophets talking about? When the prophets talk about the handling of money and the threat of the way people handle money, mm-hmm. What are they talking about?
Okay. And you're asking me, an economist, to respond to a scholar that works on those sorts of issues. I think they're talking about a couple of things. Oftentimes they're talking about contract violation. They're talking about the poor didn't get what was due to them, that you took what you had promised to them. So there's at least some of that in Amos and other places. But they're talking about people didn't behave as they were supposed to. And the other thing I think that they're talking about is one of the big issues of a wealthy society is that wealth can become all-consuming. Right? It can become the thing that we do worship. And I just think Deuteronomy 8 has always been an interesting passage. Because here they are going into the promised land, and he's telling them it's going to be a land of milk and honey. And he says, be careful, because you will say, by my own hand, by my own strength, I created this. And so I do think, I think that everything that God blesses us with probably has a particular temptation. And I think that wealth has a particular temptation of self-sufficiency, hedonism, those sorts of things. So that's what I think about.
So how do we sort that out corporately? Because part of the conversation that we're having is in how we individually approach this. But then when you ask the question at a more societal level, you ask those kinds of questions, how do you begin to get at that? And I am asking this as a theologian to an economist, so I'm interested.
Okay. How do we get at, say, the problem of wealth accumulation? Or?
And thinking about that as a community that is trying to, if I can say it this way, put it in a positive sense, mutually benefit one another without abusing one another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're exploiting them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, respecting the dignity of all, and I actually think some of our efforts to engage in redistribution does not respect dignity of all. I find, you know, the When Helping Hurts book very useful in terms of that. You think my attitude in terms of it's very easy to be in, think we're in this power position of we know we're in one of these communities and we're going to do all of those sorts of things. I do not see a way to deal with the wealth problem coercively as long as very useful. As long as the wealth is achieved legitimately through mutually beneficial exchanges.
Can I pop in and just add something? I think one possible metric that is implied by what you just said, if you want to ask how do we get tangible? If you take a list of the wealthiest individuals in the world, if you know something about those people and how they made their money, you can fairly easily distinguish the people who got wealthy by serving customers and the people who got wealthy by exploiting their personal relationships, exploiting favoritism in various ways, cronyism, that kind of thing. So what if we were to be asking the question, what percent of our wealthy people got wealthy through serving customers, and what percent of our wealthy people got wealthy by exploiting access to power? Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm not saying that's the only metric, but what if we added that metric alongside other metrics? That would be a way of kind of measuring how we're doing.
So, Darrell, do you have more that you want? I'm not sure that I've answered that.
Well,
very
well. I think all I'm trying to raise here is I think there's an inherent tension about how we talk about this area. Mm-hmm. And in that inherent tension, we do have to wrestle with the fact that we've got a significant portion of Scripture that does engage us on thinking through, for lack of a better term, the justice of how we handle the resources that God has given us and the stewardship that we have. And a danger I can see in this kind of a presentation, although it's very, very helpful at one level to say, look, this isn't all bad. This actually does benefit us. And if it works, and it works well, everybody comes out positive. But the other threat is that cloud, that dark cloud is sitting back there. Right. It's also coming at us that we have to think about and put into the equation.
We've got a couple minutes left. Charlie, what's your response?
Maybe related to Darrell's last comment, comment on fair wage and minimum wage economically, because that's where we are on the ground.
Yeah. On the ground, minimum wage, I act, this is going to tell you where I come from, but I think minimum wage is one of the worst things we do to the people that are left out. Because it says to them, until they're worth $7.25 an hour, they can't get a job. They have to figure out some way to get to be worth $7.25 an hour. Teenagers, minorities, people have bad education, lots of groups, for obviously no fault of their own, are not worth that. But what would be the best way for them to become worth that? Getting a job, doing these sorts of things. And so there's a strange sort of situation. So by and large, not exclusively, but by and large, economists would say, minimum wage, though well-intentioned, but all sorts of harms. Let me take one more question, and I think we're out of time.
Well, another point about minimum wage, another way to say that is to say you're telling someone you're not allowed to sell your labor for a price that you think it's worth. You have to sell it for a price that I think it's worth.
Right.
As a government official. And part of the answer to Darrell's question, what do we do? How do we address all this? Is well, we do what you said when you said government's purpose is to maintain order, and part of that is for government to respect the rule of law. and contract law in particular. And we also shouldn't assume that a government official, just by virtue of being a government official, has some type of noble, virtuous motive behind him, whereas a private entrepreneur doesn't.
Right.
We can't make that assumption.
Yeah. We're out of time. I'm going to offer you a slight bonus here. If you want to stay around, here's a recent branding roundup at our ranch. play it for you, but you should also go take your break, and we're due back here, what, in half an hour?
Half an hour. Would you please join me in thanking people?
We are giving you a break, so please be back here at 10:30. These entrepreneurs are so annoying. Yes, go ahead and stay if you want. Go if you want. 10:30.
This is 4 minutes of a recent
Greg, when we reconvene,
hold on. Can I make a... Hang on.